Russia's defense minister is replaced.
We witnessed the removal of Sergei Shoigu, who's been the defense minister since 2012.
Thousands of Georgians protest.
I want Georgia to live in Europe. I do not want to wake up in Russia.
And Americans went to Paris to see Taylor Swift because it was cheaper than seeing the concert at home.
Well, the tickets, like I said, in Miami, Florida, they were going for like $2,800, and that's for nosebleed seats. For here, I think the minimum price of tickets was like $300.
Today is Monday, May 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Sunday replaced Sergei Shoigu as defense minister in a cabinet shakeup that comes 2 years into the Ukraine war. Putin signed a decree on Sunday appointing Shoigu as Secretary of Russia's National Security Council. The Kremlin said the appointment was announced shortly after Putin proposed Andrei Belousov to become the country's defense minister in place of Shoigu. Let's get some insight into this. Joining us now is Rajan Menon, director of the Grand Strategy Program at Defense Priorities. Let's start by just what did we just witness, do you think?
So we witnessed the removal of Sergei Shoigu, who's been the defense minister since 2012. And he's very close to Putin, but there have been rumors that he was set to be replaced. Not entirely clear whether it had to do with the concerns of the conduct of the war. It may have had to do with the fact that some weeks ago, a deputy defense minister named Timur Ivanov, was removed on corruption charges. But the new person who is going to step in to replace Shoigu is a guy named Andrei Belousov. And what is interesting about him is that his entire career, from when he graduated from Moscow State University in 1981 with the economics degree, has been in economics and ended up most recently in January 2020 as the first deputy prime minister.
So he taps an economist to run the armed forces. Why do you think he did that?
One is that although the fundamentals of the Russian economy appear to be fine, in other words, growth is good, oil and gas revenues are coming in, the war has become pretty expensive. It's taking up about 40% of the national budget now. This year's defense budget over 2023 is about a 70% increase. And one has to wonder whether part of Belousov's brief is to manage the defense budget in a way that the war can be prosecuted while the economic fundamentals are also okay. Because ultimately, in terms of Putin's support and legitimacy, the economy has to perform well.
And what about Shoigu? He's not really being fired. He's being shifted.
You know, it's not clear whether this is an entirely a demotion for him, because he is going to replace the person who's known to be the closest to Putin and probably the most hawkish in the government, maybe more than Putin himself. A guy named Nikolai Patrushev, who has been the secretary of the National Security Council. And Shoigu is going to go into that role, but will bring with him some of the powers that he had as defense minister. So the person who I'm most curious about in this reshuffle is Patrushev, because he and Putin go way back. So he was the Secretary of the Security Council. He's been there since 2012. And before that, he was the head of the FSB, the Federal Security Service.
What are their challenges in terms of defense? I mean, obviously, the war, as you pointed out, is expensive. It's 7%, I think, of GDP at this point. But they also are fighting another battle that also has to do with economics, and that's the future. As China and the United States pour untold amounts of money into new technology, drones, AI,
robotics.
Right.
Green energy.
It creates a problem for Russia if they don't keep up, right?
Right. I mean, I like to say to people, and you might run this experiment, go home and look around in your house and see how many high-end manufactured things you'll see made in Russia. Probably we'll see stuff made in the United States, Japan, South Korea, likely even China, but you won't see anything from Russia. Which doesn't mean that the Russian economy is a basket case, but it is very much an economy that is dependent on raw materials. And it hasn't been able to break into high-end things, as you mentioned, like AI, robotics, green energy, and so on. Whereas the Chinese, South Koreans, the United States, Western Europe have been able to do so. And then you have an economy that these days, because oil prices are high and gas prices are high, is raking in a lot of money. But eventually there'll be a downturn in energy prices, and that will be a very big problem. Mm.
Thank you so much for the time again.
Yeah, absolutely, Scott. Be in touch, okay?
Yes, will do. Rajan Menon, director of the Grand Strategy Program at Defense Priorities. So who is Andrei Belousov? Joining us to talk about that part of the story is Sergei Sanovich, a Hoover Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Belousov doesn't have a military background. He comes from economics. So now he's in charge of the Russian military.
So I'd say it's definitely an interesting appointment, not unprecedented, though. Before Shoigu, the Ministry of Defense was a guy from a tax collection department. And actually, despite him being dismissed later because of a corruption scandal, he actually did important reforms in the sort of management of the Ministry of Defense, which I think many military experts said were useful and successful. And I think specifically reveals that Putin believes that arms race is here to stay. This is, I think, not just about the moment and the war and the offensive in Kharkiv.
So what do we know about Belousov?
Is a professional academic economist. He worked in the Soviet then Russian Academy of Sciences. Only after that he went on to work in the government. And for the past 20 years at least, he was the most outspoken proponent among top Russian economic leadership of more active government intervention into the economy. So there was this historical rivalry between people who were sort of more pro-market and still, you know, for example, the current head of the central bank, even the current finance minister, they're sort of more fiscally conservative, more about, letting the market, decide. Belousov is sort of more old school in that sense. And in his new position, this would be this is perfect match. He will be working on mobilizing Russian industrial base for defense production now and in the future, talking about, more advanced weapons, starting with drones. And, this requires sort of collaboration with civilian industry, engineering centers, development schools, and so forth. So he's certainly tapped for that function.
Because they're spending, what, about 7% of GDP on the war effort right now? Is that right?
It's very hard to estimate because most of that is these days black budget. It's in black budgets, which include Ministry of Defense, but there is also National Guard, you know, various security services, private military companies like Wagner, which used to operate in cash economy in the billions or tens of billions of rubles. So I think part of Belousov's mandate would be sort of to improve the accountability in this sector. I think Belousov is considered sort of more of a clean hands. And I think it would be expectation on Putin's behalf that he would sort of make sure that these vast sums of money that are now spent and will be spent on defense production would be spent a bit better, and sort of the bang for the buck that they will get would be higher.
Thank you so very much for the time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Sergei Sonovich, a Hoover Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Samford University. We're following these other stories from around the world. Spain's socialists won the biggest share of the vote in Sunday's Catalan elections, dealing a serious blow to more than 10 years of separatist governance and the independence dream still held by some in that part of the country. The season's first major wildfires have spread to roughly 10,000 hectares across western Canada on Sunday, as authorities issued an evacuation order for a community in British Columbia and warned of poor air quality across the provinces. At least 31 people died, 15 still missing, and over 40 people injured following heavy rain that brought floods and landslides to Indonesia's province of West Sumatra. Hundreds of people have been killed and more than 1,600 injured in flash flooding in northern Afghanistan. On Sunday, the Taliban-run refugee ministry said thousands of homes have been damaged and livestock wiped out following heavy rain. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 presidential election, the U.S. economy is one of the biggest issues for voters in this year's presidential contest between Democrat Joe Biden and Republican Donald Trump. Biden campaigned last week on new tech investments. Trump says he will roll back Biden infrastructure spending and boost oil drilling. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has our story.
Joe Biden campaigned on technology investments this week in the Midwest state of Wisconsin, where Microsoft is spending $3.3 billion on a new data center that Biden says is, quote, another example of the private sector optimism.
So far, we've created $866 billion in private sector investment nationwide, almost $1 trillion. Historic amounts, such a short time. Now, it's literally creating hundreds of thousands of jobs, building new semiconductor factories, electric vehicles and battery factories, and so much more, here, all here in America.
The site of the new Microsoft data center is the same spot where, 6 years ago, Donald Trump announced a $10 billion investment by the electronics manufacturer Foxconn. That complex was meant to create 13,000 new jobs for Wisconsin. It was not built. Biden called that another broken promise from Trump.
In fact, he came here with your Senator Ron Johnson literally holding a golden shovel, promising to build the eighth wonder of the world. Are you kidding me? Look what happened. They dug a hole with those golden shovels, and then they fell into it.
Trump says Biden is mishandling the U.S. economy, citing a rise in annual inflation.
The economy is not doing well. You see, inflation is through the roof. They're not going to be able to lower interest rates if they do. It's purely political, but it'll be very bad if they do.
Trump is campaigning against Biden infrastructure spending, including on clean energy and technology.
And upon taking office, I will impose an immediate moratorium on all new
spending grants and giveaways under the Joe Biden mammoth socialist bills like the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. We're going to save all that money.
Biden says that infrastructure spending helps the U.S. economy.
In addition, the roads and highways and so much more would be made with American products, built by American workers, creating good-paying American jobs.
Trump says his jobs plan includes rolling back limits on oil drilling and protecting U.S. workers from illegal immigrant labor.
What's my plan for jobs, you said?
Yes.
My plan for jobs is to drill, baby, drill, to bring energy down, to close up the border, to get rid of all the criminals that are being allowed into our country.
An April Harvard Caps Harris poll shows inflation is the most important issue for U.S. voters, with just one in three saying the economy is on the right track. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Thousands of Georgians gathered outside the Parliament building in Tbilisi on Sunday to protest against a law on foreign agents a day before the bill's third reading.
I want Georgia to live in Europe. I do not want to wake up in Russia. And I really hope that our generation is going to have a bright future, because I want to get education. I want to get educated in Europe, not in Russia. And I have this sincere fear, and I want to ask this government, what does it really give you that it costs you our fear?
The dispute over the bill has come to be seen as key to whether Georgia, which has traditional warm relations with the West, continues to push for European Union and NATO membership, or instead builds ties with Russia. The EU, which granted Georgia candidate status in December, has repeatedly said the bill could jeopardize further integration with the bloc. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has delivered some of the Biden administration's strongest public criticism yet of Israel's conduct of the war in Gaza. America's top diplomat said in two television interviews that Israeli tactics have meant a horrible loss of life of innocent civilians and have failed to neutralize Hamas leaders and fighters, and actually could drive a lasting insurgency. He underscored that the United States believes Israeli forces should get out of Gaza, but also is waiting to see credible plans from Israel for security and governance in the territory after the war. Israel attacks in Gaza continued on Sunday in both the south and the north of the Strip. Details on that now from Reuters correspondent Ilan Rubens.
Israel sent tanks into eastern Jabalia in the northern Gaza Strip on Sunday. This comes after a night of heavy aerial and ground bombardments, killing and wounding dozens, the Hamas-run health ministry said. Jabalia is the biggest of Gaza's eight historic refugee camps and is home to more than 100,000 people. Late on Saturday, Israel's military spokesperson Daniel Hagari said its forces operating in Jabalia were preventing Hamas from re-establishing its military capabilities there. Also late on Saturday, an airstrike hit Deir el-Balah, killing at least eight people, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Palestinians displaced for a second time attempted to set up tents there, as Israel proceeds with its plan for a ground attack on Rafah. More families, estimated in the thousands, were leaving Rafah as Israel's military pressure intensified. Tank shells landed across the city as the army gave new evacuation orders, covering some neighborhoods in the center of the city, calling for Gazans to head to what it calls an expanded humanitarian area in Al-Mawasi. The armed wing of Hamas and the Islamic Jihad said their fighters attacked Israel forces in several areas inside Gaza. Egypt's foreign minister said on Sunday that Cairo would continue its mediation between Israel and Hamas and urged the two sides to show the flexibility and the will needed to reach a ceasefire deal.
Reuters correspondent Ilan Rubens. And finally,
là c'est la première tournée où je la vois. Je l'ai vue en 2019 au City of Lovers, qui était une petite salle, donc déjà c'était incroyable.
Taylor Swift fever struck Paris on Thursday as the highest-grossing tour in history finally arrived in Europe, with fans excited to hear songs from her latest album performed live for the first time. But I think the most interesting part of this story is not that Europeans are going to see Taylor Swift in Paris, but that Americans are.
We're here in France to see Taylor Swift. My daughter is a big Swiftie, and it was cheaper to come here to France to see her than it is to see her in America.
Okay, so just absorb that for a moment. She's saying it's cheaper to fly to Paris from the United States, rent a hotel room, get tickets to a Taylor Swift concert than it is to get tickets to a Taylor Swift show in America.
Well, the tickets, like I said, in Miami, Florida, they were going for like $2,800, and that's for nosebleed seats. For here, I think the minimum price of tickets was like $300. That's a big difference. You know, when you can pay for a flight, a hotel here, even the hotels here are cheaper than they are in the United States. So we didn't save a much money, but we got this experience out of it.
The venue said a fifth of the crowd were from the United States, many attracted by Europe's rules against charging huge markups on resale tickets, which can save Americans thousands of dollars compared with shows at home.
Absolutely. It is. The ticket prices are over the roof, plus the scalpers that buy all the tickets and jack up the price a lot.
And of course, if you go for the show, you know, there are other things you can do in Paris besides just see Taylor Swift.
I saw the Eiffel Tower. Tomorrow we're going to go to the Louvre.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. Follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com, and you can get our app from the Apple and Google store. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Each year, on May 11th, the United States observes Vietnam Human Rights Day, a day to remember the importance of advancing fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, assembly, association, and religion. Vietnam remains an authoritarian state ruled by a single party, the Communist Party of Vietnam. According to the State Department's most recent human rights report on Vietnam, there were no significant changes in the human rights situation in Vietnam in the past year. Based on reports by media, NGOs, and other observers, Vietnamese authorities, as of October 31st, held at least 187 persons for political or human rights activism, including 162 convicts and 25 in pretrial detention. According to media and human rights groups, from January 1st to October 31st, authorities detained 25 individuals and convicted 23 who were exercising internationally recognized human rights, such as the freedoms of expression, peaceful assembly, and association. Most of these arrests and convictions were linked to online blogging. Vietnam's constitution and law provide for freedom of expression, including for members of the press and other media. However, according to the Human Rights Report, the government does not respect these rights. The government continues to use broad national security and anti-defamation provisions in the law to restrict freedom of expression. Vietnam's government restricts speech that criticizes individual government leaders or the party, promotes political pluralism or multi-party democracy, or questions policies on sensitive matters such as human rights, religious freedom, sovereignty disputes with the People's Republic of China, or coercive land seizure. Independent journalists continue to face restrictions on freedom of movement, other forms of harassment, and physical attacks if they report on sensitive topics, notes the Human Rights Report. The government also monitors journalists' meetings and communications. The government punishes journalists for failing to self-censor, including by revoking journalists' press credentials. The Vietnamese government continues to exercise significant government control over religious practices, according to the latest International Religious Freedom Report. Indeed, the United States expressed its deep concern recently about the ongoing convictions of Vietnamese ethnic minority and religious freedom advocates. Five such convictions have occurred since January. As State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller has said, we call upon Vietnam to respect the rights of individuals to exercise freedoms of expression, association, and religion or belief. He added, we reiterate our call on Vietnam to release all those unjustly detained.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.